you could take an ordinary loss year one. Then when ordinary income starts flowing in, you don't pay tax until you've used up your initial ordinary loss. And then when you go to sell, you reinvest and then can take another ordinary loss against that capital gain. So you're able to not pay any tax on all of that cash flow. Like I said, if you just look at the alternative, you can automatically see how there's benefit. And then also playing the longer game, you can't use those losses initially, but you can use them in the future and then use the time value of money to your advantage in that respect.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. I'm your host, Tate Durier.
And I'm the co-host, Ryan Gibson.
And we are in Ryan's office, Spartan Investment Group office in Seattle, Washington. So nice to be here in person, man.
Yeah, good to see you. Look at this. We're live and on set. So if you haven't checked out our YouTube channel, now is a great time to do that. You can see our lovely faces.
We look great.
Yes. We're at a news anchor desk, which is kind of fun. Here, get some coffee, what pilots do.
So, that's right.
Well, this episode, super excited to bring on Billy, who runs a tax planning firm and advisory. And we're going to do things like talk about what you should be getting ready for as the season winds down for tax prep.
Yep.
We're going to talk about K-1s from syndications. Do they matter if you're not a real estate professional, or do they make sense if you're not a real estate professional? Hint, hint, it still matters. So yep, there's still benefits. And then we're going to actually jump into things like best practices for, should you file extensions, tax extensions this year,
yep,
or next year? Some considerations there. As with any of these episodes, we're not giving you tax, legal, or professional advice. Just seek your own due diligence. Call your attorney. Make sure this is just a friendly conversation to help the flying community. And again, we're not giving this advice. We're just having a friendly conversation and bringing on experts like Billy who can give that advice. So
exactly. And Billy, he's a strategist. He's an enrolled agent, which we'll get into. And I'm really excited for this conversation because one of the biggest complaints that I hear about people's CPA firms is, they don't strategize with me. There's nothing forward looking. All of a sudden, the tax deadline's there. It's like, give me your stuff. Bam, we file. There's no preemptive conversations. There's no, looking at where you want to go over the next 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, and creating a plan for that and an active plan for tax mitigation. So Billy's all about that. I think people will take a lot away from this.
You know, the other thing that people always do too is like they go to their CPA and they listen to our show, or they go to a conference, or they get this information and they go to their CPA and they say, hey, I learned all this stuff that I can help mitigate my taxes. And their CPA goes, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I've never heard about that.
Yeah, I've never heard about that. That sounds like a scam, or that's going to make you get an audit. And that's just clearly you're in the wrong office. You're talking to the wrong person. Right?
You are. I mean, there's so many caveat little pockets of the tax code. So you have to have a CPA that's doing what you're doing. And if you're a high-income W-2 professional and you want to offset your taxes, I'm sorry, but real estate, basically, that's it.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
You want a CPA that knows real estate and knows all of those loopholes to take advantage of. So
with that, let's get to the show.
Billy, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Yeah, so I'd like to just get right into it. Can you give us a bit about your background, other than having a name like a blues musician? Tell us about your background. Where are you from? How'd you get into the tax strategy game and the tax game?
Definitely. So I was a military brat, so I moved around a lot, settled in Chicago. That's how I ended up with an undergraduate in accounting from Northern Illinois University. But as soon as I came out of that program, I knew I wanted to do taxes full time as a career. So I went to the University of Denver, earned a Master of Taxation, and kicked off my career helping real estate investors save money on their taxes. Spent well over the last decade kind of honing my craft and becoming really good at that, and being able to explain to people all the benefits of using the tax code to pay less in taxes, and have carved out a niche with, short-term rental investors, people who invest in syndications as limited partners, and the more traditional landlord as well. pretty much all walks of life in real estate, you know, developers, flippers, all this. And to me, it's a really great way to build wealth. And I've seen it with my clients and I've helped my clients with it. So that's why I enjoyed, you know, preparing and strategizing with real estate investors with their taxes.
You know, I think that's such a great niche to be able to carve out a segment that specifically deals with real estate investors. And I'd imagine, Billy, you have some investors that are also working a W-2 job while they're also real estate investing, which is basically the point of our show. That's all of us. That was me. You know, I built my real estate portfolio while I was flying full time and transitioning from how I was taxed and as an airline professional to how I'm taxed as a real estate professional are two completely different things.
Right.
And two different parts of the tax code. So that transitions into our first question, which is, you know, why should a real estate investor work with a tax strategist like yourself to help best position them for success?
Definitely. So when you're working with a tax strategist, what we can do is align your goals with your actions, and those actions should be as tax efficient as possible. So for example, if you're somebody who wants to build wealth passively, you'll need to know how to make all of the right moves to avoid, you know, Uncle Sam coming in and taking a cut of those taxes. Because usually in real estate, when there is a taxable event, getting ahead of that allows you to mitigate that versus most people who wait until April 15th, speak to their tax professional, and by then it's too late because the event has already happened. So if we can get in front of these, you know, taxable events, plan for them, figure out what to do with the proceeds, whether, you know, if you're buy and hold, a 1031 exchange, if you're a passive investor, reinvesting into another passive investment, or if you want to do something different, such as getting into short-term rentals, we can plan and strategize all of those moves ahead of time so that there's no surprises on April 15th.
As we say, you got to change your facts, change your tax, right?
That's
the name of the game. And this is so great. This is why we wanted to have you on, is because, you know, one of the biggest questions that I get asked is hey, my CPA is not so good. All they do is file my taxes. There's no strategy. There's no conversation ahead of time on, you know, what I should be doing to proactively mitigate. And again, as you mentioned, you get to April 15th, there's nothing you can do anymore because all of the tax, everything that's going to affect your tax bill is going to happen throughout the year. It doesn't happen on April 15th.
Exactly.
You can't maybe switch CPAs and go, and they wave a magic wand and all of a sudden you owe less tax. It's like, it's all a result of the actions that you took throughout the year. So what are the top five things that you would recommend for someone who's making, you know, $300,000 to $750,000, some of us in the airline world now, to start on this mission of reducing our tax bill? If say someone has a primary residence, they've maybe got one rental property, but they've never done any sort of a cost segregation study on that. They're just scratching the surface of syndications. What advice would you give them?
Definitely. So it always comes down to what are your goals? A lot of people I talk to are not interested in, you know, starting a whole new business, which sometimes that's what real estate is. On the flip side, if you are full bore wanting to get into real estate as much as you can, you know, I've worked with pilots in the past who only work half the year, or maybe their spouse is really interested in real estate as well. And so they can go to the extreme other end of the spectrum and turning all of those passive losses into active losses via, you know, either the real estate professional status or, you know, starting a short-term rental business and qualifying for the short-term rental loophole. Like you said there too, you can take advantage of cost segregation studies in both of those cases to really supercharge your deductions that you're able to take against your W-2 income. So I would say, for anyone looking to really leverage the tax code to benefit their W-2 taxable income or reduce it, I should say, the first step is to make sure you are treating it as a business and make sure you're set up properly with proper record keeping, making sure you're tracking your time so that we can leverage things like the short-term rental loophole, material participation hours, or the real estate professional status hours. And then from there, make sure your accounting records are, you know, fully up to date on a consistent basis. You have to truly treat it as a business to fully take advantage of the tax code. Next, I would say cost segregation study is something to explore. Cost segregation study is something that is a study from an engineer that says the building that you purchase is broken into different depreciable class lives. And the shorter the depreciable class life is, the more tax advantageous it is. But you need an engineer to complete that study because they're the only ones qualified to tell you or the IRS what those different values of the building that you purchased are. And then from there, using that extra depreciation to offset any other income. And that is helpful whether you're passive or non-passive in your real estate investments, because step number three is if you're investing passively, you can offset all of your forms of passive income with other losses. So say, for example, if you have a rental and you've never done a cost segregation study on it, you can then get passive streams of income from maybe a syndication and then use the losses from, say, a cost segregation study to offset that income. So those are probably the top three that I can come up with right now.
I really like that. And, you know, it's a lot for someone who hasn't maybe listened to our prior episode with Toby Mathis from Anderson Advisors. So if you haven't, jump back. I think it's episode 10 and 12.
10 and 14.
10 and 14.
And then we also had Yona Weiss on to talk, do a deep dive on cost segregation studies. So if you need to pause this episode and go back. And get some real background education, or just go back at some other point, those are really, really top-notch episodes.
I did want to say, though, so you know, you can certainly listen to the show, and the show is designed to give real estate investors practical advice that they can apply right away. And so, you know, let's make this a little bit more practical, Billy. If somebody were to reach out to your team, you know, what's that look like? You know, they've never worked with a tax strategist before. They've never had a phone call. You know, maybe they're just doing their 1065 through TurboTax. You know, kind of walk us through what a tax strategist does for a real estate investor and what that would look like.
Definitely. So I would say, in my experience, not only through my own firm, but working with others and in others myself as well, what we usually do is start out with understanding your goals and identifying any quick hit opportunities from prior year tax returns that we can immediately implement in your business. So say, for example, actually, I was just dealing with another investor the other day where she reported a IRA sourced passive income in her personal tax return, which obviously she shouldn't be paying tax on that because it's in her IRA. So immediately amending that return is going to provide instant value to her. But, and then also the education piece of going forward, do not report this on your personal tax return. That's obviously a big, you know, piece of it as well. Then from there, we determine your goals and figure out the most tax advantaged way to meet those goals. So if your goal is to buy 10 long-term rentals, make sure that you, you know, set up your accounting records, like I said, make sure we do a cost segregation study when it makes sense, and then continue to operate that as a business so that we can potentially down the line become a real estate investor full-time with real estate professional status or whatever that needs to look like. So we then understand your goals and then lay out a plan for you to implement and then help you implement it over the course of the engagement. Then that way we get to the end of the engagement, we're already going to know what's going to happen on April 15th, and you'll be armed with the knowledge that you need going forward, so that your tax bill will be minimized as much as possible going forward.
Now, is that an hourly rate? Is it a lump sum? Is it a membership? Is it a monthly fee? How do you kind of structure your, or how does advisories work?
We run our advisory service fixed fee, and we usually look to give you immediate ROI with those quick fix implements, like I mentioned. But then also that investment pays dividends because you'll be armed with the knowledge going forward year in and year out to not pay tax in the future and have less surprises on April 15th.
That's great. And is there different levels? You know, maybe you have a light version, a medium, or kind of a consultation to make sure that there is value to impact and there is ROI before someone would have to commit?
Definitely. So like most other accounting firms, we start the consultation with looking at your prior year tax returns, making sure that we can add value, and a brief phone call to figure out your situation and lightly determine your goals. We obviously don't get very in-depth on the consultation, but we use that to determine to make sure we can add value. And in our most basic strategy engagement, we can help any kind of real estate investor who wants to grow their portfolio in a tax-efficient manner. If you're somebody who's self-employed, either in the real estate space or in other spaces as well, but also have that real estate interest as well, we have custom packages that we can not only help your business succeed, but also your real estate investment business succeed. And then those are custom scoped because there could be a lot of different moving parts depending on what you need.
That's great.
That's excellent. So I've got a bunch of questions. You know, I've been wanting on this show to do a deep dive on real estate professional status for a long time. I think that'd be really beneficial. I'd love to talk about entity structure for your own personal assets. And then, you know, if you can't accomplish real estate professional status, what are some of the other ways? So before we dive into the real estate professional stuff, Billy, if you wouldn't mind doing that, Ryan, did you want to touch on anything before we went down that rabbit hole?
No, I definitely want to make this practical for people who are, you know, we're sitting in October, we're recording this right as of October 3rd of 2023. And Spartan, we're already preparing our tax returns for 2023.
Right.
Right. Because we have thousands of K-1s to get out to our investors as the year turns over. What I want to get into what an investor right now needs to be thinking about for the remainder of the year, because we are about to wrap up 2023, and I just don't want investors to miss out on anything they should be doing in this tax year,
right,
to miss out on a potential deduction.
Yeah.
And I also wanted to talk about what is phasing out this year,
yes,
or changing this year, so that people can, you know, also leverage that and make this really practical, because we're going to try to push this episode out, you know, hopefully in October. So,
yep.
Definitely. So I'll start in with year end, and then we can definitely get into everything else as well. So in the next couple of weeks, what you need to be doing is, if you bought any properties, make sure you have all of the settlement statements and all of the invoices for any improvements that you make to the properties. You know, the power of depreciation is really unlocked when the, you know, tax professional that you're working with has all of that information in front of them to make the most advantageous decision for you. For those of us who like to sit on their books until the absolute last minute, not saying I'm one of those people, but yeah, I know there's a lot of
not for my business, but for personal.
Yeah, for
like
personal.
I think I still need to file my tax returns.
Yeah, we got our K-1s were a top priority, but I'm still working on my personal returns.
All the investors
pushing up against the October 15th deadline here.
All my investors get hooked up. I get last.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Well, the last thing you want to be doing is, you know, in between Thanksgiving and all the other year-end holidays, is working on accounting. You want to be spending that time with family and friends and, you know, remembering the year that was. So it's probably a good idea to get a jump on your books and records today, you know, especially if you are somebody who uses the de minimis safe harbor, which allows you to write off immediately any expense under $2,500 per invoice line item. You're going to want to reflect that in your books and records to ensure that it's bulletproof when you make that election on your tax return. So again, just going through your books and records, making sure they're up to date and that capitalization policy from the de minimis safe harbor is in place. And then combining that with all of your invoices and any purchase or sale settlement statements, you'll have your data organized for your tax professional to go over. Next thing is, I would definitely schedule a strategy session with a tax advisor, because you will want to make sure that all of those facts are in alignment before year end. So if there's any changes that need to be done, or for example, say if you have the opportunity to pay your kids to work in your business, you can do that between now and year end. So it's probably a better idea to schedule sooner rather than later. But even so, I helped a client, you know, purchase a truck in the last few weeks of the year, and we were able to use that. Whereas if he waited till January, he would not have been able to use that to his advantage. So
maybe start with a consultation.
Start with a consultation.
And then kind of think about the things that maybe you need to do prior to year end versus trying to figure it all out. And then maybe you have the consultation and it's December, it's too late.
Right.
Or you have to move really fast and it's the holidays and everybody knows how that is. So.
Great. I would agree.
Yeah, great.
And then as far as things that are changing, so if you've been following along with bonus depreciation, it used to be on personal property, you could take a deduction in full in year one up until last year. This year, you can only take an 80% deduction in year one, and the next year in 60% in year one. So if there's any personal property, say, for example, you want to install new flooring, or if you need to buy a new laptop, something like that, you want to get those purchases in before year end to be able to write off 80% versus next year only 60%. So that's definitely a big
one. And that would have to be for business use, right? I mean, you couldn't just buy it you know, in your own personal name.
Correct. Any business purchase.
Right. Yeah, shout out to syndications. If you're thinking about making a syndication or an investment, the end of the year is the last chance to really grab that 80% bonus depreciation.
Right.
So, you know, I know you have deals open. We have deals open. So if you wanted to get that depreciation in this tax year, you have to make that investment prior to December 31st.
Right. So, yep. So And of course, it depends on the deal how much depreciation loss there's going to be.
Correct. Yep.
But of that, of all the depreciation loss, you know, you're going to be able to capture 80% of that bonus depreciation this year. So it's just, it's more powerful this year than it will be next year.
Correct. That's right.
And the last tip that I have for year end is, if you know that you had a big distribution from a syndication, take a look at your form 8582 from your 2022 tax return. And if the loss listed on that form carrying forward to next year is smaller than the gain that you expect to realize, you're probably going to have some tax to pay this year if you don't make other investments. So probably best to leave that one to the professionals, but if you feel like you can take that on yourself, definitely have a look at that form and do some back of the napkin math to see if there's any surprises that you need to strategize for come April 15th.
Billy, what would the question be to your tax professional? How would you frame that question?
You would say, I want to ensure that I have sufficient passive losses to not pay any tax on this capital gain event in 2023. Can you help me understand if I have enough passive losses or if I need to make any of our investments before year end to mitigate my tax bill?
Love it. Perfect.
I want to pile on to that as well, because really what we're talking about here is a syndication deal is going full cycle. You have suspended losses that you've carried forward that you weren't able to use in prior years. You're using those losses to offset the gain that's happening now that you're getting all your money back plus some profit on sale, right? And what you said there was, are there sufficient losses in place already that I've carried forward to offset this capital gain, or do I need to make another investment? This is what I refer to as the lazy man's 1031, right?
Right.
As, you know, you don't have to. I get the question all the time. It's like, what happens when a deal goes full cycle? Can I 1031 in the next one? The answer is usually no.
You However,
well, right. Well, into the DST, right?
Yeah.
Into it.
That's a whole other topic.
That's a whole other topic. Usually the answer is no. You can't 1031 from one syndication deal into the next. However, if you invest in another syndication deal, which generates a lot of bonus depreciation year one losses, that can offset the gain from the deal that just went full cycle and you just got the big pop and return of capital and return on sale. Am I correct in that, Billy?
You nailed it. And then one other idea too could be, if you were thinking about buying a hard asset of your own, buying a rental of your own as well, doing so this year versus next year could move the needle for you.
Tomorrow I'm headed down to Reno.
Nice.
To do a walkthrough on the next physical property that I'm buying. We'll be doing a cost segregation study on that and using some bonus depreciation at 80% this year versus next year. So,
and it's going to go on Airbnb?
It will.
Yeah, nice.
Excited about that.
If you're in the Reno area and you're looking for a nice place to stay.
That's right.
You know,
new build. It's beautiful. Yeah.
I love it.
So let's dive into the real estate professional status, because, you know, we get a ton of questions about this. And I think there's a lot more complexity behind it than just, you know, scratching the surface. Billy, I will preface this conversation with the fact that from my previous conversations with tax professionals, airline pilots are one of the only high paid professions that it is actually possible to make this work, because we fly so few block hours per year. 1,000 block hours a year is the most we can possibly fly. If you're on reserve and you only end up flying 30 hours a month, then, you know,
there you go.
Your block hours greatly reduce. Now, that's not to say that it's easy. And if you have a spouse that's not working, it might be easier for them to qualify. But let's dive into the whole thing. Let's start with the 750 hours. And then we'll move into material participation. So let me let you take it away, since you're the expert.
Yeah, thank you. And so the 750 hours, as you said, you have to spend 750 hours in a real property trade or business. So using your rentals could qualify, assuming that you manage them yourself. But for example, if you're also thinking about doing your own syndications or doing your own real estate agent business on the side as well, that would be... those are probably the top three ways of becoming or spending 750 hours. But then the second caveat on that 750 hours is it needs to be more than half of your time spent in non-real property trades or businesses, for example, being an airline pilot. So if you spend 1,000 hours a year flying, then you will need to spend 1,001 hours in real estate. And that is achievable, but it's harder to do if you have one long-term rental in your portfolio and that's it. So really, you know, working with a tax professional to kind of understand those nuances and then come up with a solid game plan that will help you achieve that initial hour threshold is probably the best thing that you can do if you want to seriously become a real estate professional. Because it, as you mentioned, it's not easy.
I was just going to preface this with, if someone's wondering, you know, why would I even want to qualify? Can we just touch on that real quick, and then I'll let you keep going on number two?
Definitely. So when you qualify as a real estate professional, your passive income becomes non-passive, and non-passive losses can offset your W-2 income. So if we can generate losses through real estate, which is fairly common, because you generate paper losses from, say, depreciation, or you make significant investments into the property that you can deduct in the year that you make those investments, you're able to then shield that W-2 income from taxes, hopefully get a refund, and then reinvest that refund into more real estate. And that's why we like the real estate professional status.
Excellent. Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, the second part of real estate professional is materially participating in your passive rentals. So for example, you need to be self-managing the property or have a large enough portfolio where you manage the managers. And then you have to do that for at least 500 hours. And that can be done with your spouse in conjunction with your spouse and to meet that threshold. So say, for example, if you are spending, you know, more than half your time managing the rental, but your spouse also helps you, that will be okay. But if, you know, just to keep it plain, expect to be the property manager on your rentals in order to achieve that.
Now, as pilots, we carry around a little logbook, and every time we fly, we write it. Or
maybe, some of us do.
I don't anymore.
I stopped logging about 10 years ago.
Yeah, but we also know that our airlines have systems that keep track of our hours, et cetera, et cetera. So as a pilot, like when you're saying 500 hours, like we're probably immediately thinking, like, I'm getting out my Jeppesen logbook, right, and I'm like writing down the hour that I worked. Billy, what's practical with that? Do we really have to get out a logbook and log that? How do you prove that 500 hours? Or do you have to prove it? Yeah.
Yes, you do have to prove it to your tax professional. It's not something that gets submitted to the IRS, but they may request one. And the IRS being the way that they are, they really do like the written logbook. That said, as something in, you know, spreadsheet format is totally acceptable. Keeping track of all your time in your Google Calendar is totally acceptable. The key is just logging exactly what you did and where you went and who you saw, and then making sure that that time spent or the time that was logged reflects what we need it to reflect, meaning you materially participated. You were not just an investor in your properties.
And there's two requirements for that logbook, right? My understanding is it has to be contemporaneous, meaning you can't put it together on April 14th for the prior year. And number two, it has to be reasonable. So if it says you met with a tenant for 6 hours, it's like, well, that doesn't sound reasonable, right?
But can I pick on you for a second?
Please.
You flew all the way out to Seattle to sit in our office and record this podcast.
Yeah, true.
I mean, and then you overnighted and you got up this morning and you're in the office all day. This is, you know, that is a 16 hour.
True. However, Billy, correct me if I'm wrong, but transportation is kind of a sticky one, right? It's like if you have a bunch of properties and they're all 5 hours apart, you know, you can't just be like, well, I spent, you know, 600 hours in the car and, you know, another 150 actually
managing.
That
would not be the ideal scenario. Yeah. What we like to say is, let's be able to throw the book at the IRS and show that you actually spent 1800 hours doing all of this. But 800 of it may have been travel and therefore not the best argument.
The flying time can be logged as cross-country time, right?
True.
Solo cross-country
Solo cross-country. Yeah, backseat PIC.
Right.
So I want to really separate out the 750 hours and the 500 hours here.
Yeah.
Because this is a source of big confusion. So let's just talk about the 750 for a moment. And anyone who has a spouse who is a property manager, real estate agent, alarm bells should be going off in your head going, I already might qualify for this if they get the material participation piece later on. So can we touch on that? The 750, right? The just to get the 750 hours of real estate related activities, and then we can really dive into the material participation piece afterwards.
Yeah. So when you have a spouse who is already participating in real estate professional trader business, that's the ideal scenario. For example, if they only spend 750 hours, you know, for example, being a real estate agent, and they have no interest in managing tenants, things like that, perhaps that's where you could come in, use your material participation hours on the rental side, and then them being a real estate professional full time, you guys could work together on that to, in conjunction, qualify for real estate professional status and then use any losses from real estate to offset W-2 income and the earned income from being in a real property trader business for your spouse.
Excellent. Can we talk about the material participation piece now? Because that 500 hours of material participation, I think, gets lost a lot of the time. So how many properties do you need to reasonably, you know, call 500 hours of material participation? Like if someone has one property and then a bunch of syndication deals, is that enough? What's that threshold look like?
Reasonably, it could be enough to have just one property that you manage, because it would have to be a scenario where you are actually managing renovations yourself, right? So going out to not only collect rent, meet tenants, but then also manage the renovation and oversee them as well. Or even I've worked with clients who want to do the renovations themselves. That would be the best way, because the difference in material participation is, you know, kind of a threshold to keep in the back of your mind. What would a property manager do versus what would an investor do? And if an investor would do it, it's not going to be the best argument that you materially participated in your rental.
Understood.
Is this going to cause an audit? That's a question I get all the time. It's like, man, what you guys do is too tricky, and it's going to create, I think it's going to throw up a red flag and I'm going to get audited and the world's going to end and I'll have to never do anything ever again in my life. So
so I can't say for sure whether or not it will trigger an audit. What I can say is that you should only take this position if it's bulletproof, and that's the advantage of working with a tax professional.
Gotcha.
They can review your log. They can help you formulate the log in the first place. And then if you guys both agree that this is a position that's reasonable to take, then you could take the position and sleep well at night knowing that if an audit ever comes up, you're well prepared to defend it.
That's such a yeah. good line right there. That's it. Exactly. Work with a tax professional. You know, this should be a team sport for everyone, right? So build your network, build the team around you so that you can move forward with confidence and not just be sort of flailing in the wind with this stuff, right?
Yeah.
Certainly exactly. Don't decide to be a real estate professional and then do your taxes on TurboTax. That probably would not be the best way to proceed, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so
I've seen people do it, but I don't recommend it.
Let's talk about entity structure, because right now, and we can move into the passive stuff, you know, as a segue into the next conversation. But let's talk about the active. Let's talk about actually buying physical real estate. We want to qualify for this real estate professional status. We decide, hey, I'm going to need at least one rental property that I'm going to go and manage, or I have one. I want to buy one more. I'm going to do the cost segregation study, and I'm going to be able to offset a bunch of my W-2 this year. Let's talk about LLCs. Which comes first, the chicken or the egg, right? Do I need the LLC before I buy the property? Do I buy the property first in my own personal name and then I transfer it over? If I buy it as a primary residence, can I flip it over to an LLC later? I'm just going to open that whole can of worms for you and just sort of let you handle it like you would with a client here.
Definitely. So when you are getting started in real estate, you do not need an LLC for any specific tax advantage. For example, you can deduct anything that you would, whether you have an LLC or not. But that said, it's probably best to set up an LLC on the earlier side of things, because you can then be in a better position to take advantage of any kind of retroactive benefits if you need to, once you speak with your tax professional. So really the answer of whether or not you need an LLC lies in a discussion with an attorney, whether or not it makes sense for you from a liability standpoint. However, like I said, if you're going to do it anyway, or if you're confident you're going to do it anyway, setting it up sooner should not be any issue.
If it's a residential property, and I'm buying it as an investment property, should I be setting up the LLC ahead of time and closing the property into the LLC, or is that going to cause issues with lenders?
I've heard that it does cause issue with lenders. However, I've never seen it. So I would say definitely speak to the attorney, speak to the title company, speak to the mortgage lender. And then from there, you should have a better understanding of exactly what you're trying to do and the best way to move forward on that.
Okay. And what about best practice in terms of separate bank account, a new credit card? I'm buying this next property in a few weeks. Should I already have a separate bank account set up for it? Should I take out a new credit card so that the transactions are all on a separate account? Does it matter if I have QuickBooks? Can I just sort it out that way? What's better for an accountant to see? What makes your life easier?
Definitely. And so, you know, basically to me, the question always is, what is the most commonly missed deduction? And to me, it's the one that is not tracked. So the best thing you can do is set up a dedicated credit card for your real estate investing, your dedicated bank account for real estate investing, and then just fund that bank account with money that you want to use in real estate. Because if you, you know, try and use personal expenses, personal credit cards, and commingle in that respect, undoubtedly, you're going to miss some deductions because you're not going to want to go through all of your personal deductions that you can't take in the real estate business just to find a few to use in the real estate business. So again, treat it as a business, set things up the right way. And then from there, yeah, an accounting system like QuickBooks is going to make a lot of sense. So you just feed those accounts into there.
What about commingling between properties? So if you own three properties, you already own two, you're buying a third. So you're saying just use, you know, one credit card for all of them. Does it matter if they're all mixed together?
Definitely. I would say it depends on the level of business that you do. For example, if those are three long-term rentals, it's not going to be the end of the world to separate that out. But if you're pretty confident that you're going to be, you know, starting a new business activity, which is actually crucial, you want to keep the all separate business activities separate. So, for example, if I'm starting a short-term rental, or even if I have a short-term rental and long-term rental in the same unit, keeping those activities separate is going to give you the most flexibility when it comes to tax time.
That's excellent.
Yeah, I was going to say, from experience, this is all nice, you know, separate accounts, separate credit cards. But inevitably, what happens is you go to buy those materials and they don't accept, you know, Amex, right? Or Discover, or they only take Visa, or they don't take credit cards or whatever. So just make sure as you go through this, just from speaking from experience, make sure you have a way to quickly memorialize, hey, this had to go on my personal card because of this reason.
Yeah, I didn't have that credit card on hand. So I
expired and left it at home, whatever. I've got to buy these materials, right?
Like. Right.
So just have a way, you know, your iPhone's very powerful. I mean, you take a picture and it automatically knows it's a receipt, you know, or you can have a receipt photo album in your iPhone, things like that. Just make a note to yourself, send yourself an email. That's how I've kind of worked through it. And again, it's not perfect, but it does happen where you have the best intentions, but you just have to have those stop gaps as well. So
what are your thoughts on this, Billy? I've heard from, you know, Clint Coons, Toby Mathis, that the best way to structure your physical real estate assets is to have an LLC for each property, right? And then have a parent company, usually in Wyoming, because it affords anonymity. And then all of the profit and loss from each individual property will flow up to the parent, and it makes it easier to show on your tax return. Would you agree with that?
I would definitely agree with that. And then the only caveat is that don't let the parent company have any earned income flowing into it. So say, for example, if you get the opportunity to, you know, become a real estate agent, something like that, you're not going to want commission checks flowing into that LLC. You're going to want to open a separate LLC for any kind of earned income, but you can definitely keep all of your passive rental investments in a holding company, whether that's LP syndications or rental properties, you know, that you own outright or jointly with other people. And then just the key is there is that, you know, that's not a liability thing. You need to speak to an attorney about the liability implications from the purely tax implications. That's exactly right.
All right, Billy, I love to ask this question to all of our guests. You've been doing tax prep, and it's probably for you, it's like an airline pilot flying from Seattle to New York. It's pretty benign, same thing every time, same pre-flight, same takeoff. You know, probably not going to be much variables since the last time, other than weather and maybe some maintenance issues. But every once in a while, we have a flight where that's never happened before, or maybe you learn something, right? You know, not that you hadn't been trained for it, but what have you learned in the last 6 months that you didn't know previously? What big things have you taken away that are kind of out of the ordinary that not surprised you? Maybe they surprised you, or maybe you just learned them and said, "Oh, I didn't realize that," or "I didn't," maybe you weren't doing this with clients previously, et cetera.
That's a really good question. The first two things that come to mind are just working with somebody with extensive experience will pay dividends. And that's because, for example, I worked with a client who they tried to speak with the IRS on somebody who's not qualified to speak with the IRS. I'm an enrolled agent. I can represent all of my clients in front of the IRS, but they were working with somebody who couldn't. And for some reason, that person who could not represent the client thought that they could. And so there's at a standstill with the IRS because the IRS won't talk to this person. This person won't talk to their client, letting them know they can't talk to the IRS. And so now something has gone really stale and the client's in kind of a bad spot that I have to help them get out of. And then on the, you know, same thing as well. I had another client who nobody told them how to disclose, you know, foreign assets, foreign bank accounts. And so there's another thing that's kind of been festering that we have to untangle in pretty short order. So you just got to work with somebody and really interview them to make sure that you have confidence that they have extensive experience, just because so many things could go wrong between, you know, New York and Seattle in my world in that respect. So
yeah, exactly. And ours too, yeah. But typically a clear VFR day, if everything lines up, right, it's pretty easy. Right. But if, hey, there could be days where it's, you know, you got to deal with a lot of stuff along the way. So yeah.
That's where you want the professionals on your side.
What I love about taxes is that even clients with the exact same profile could be worlds apart. And that's what keeps it interesting for me.
Totally. Same here.
That's great. Let's switch gears into syndication. And for someone who's just like, you know, I can't qualify for the real estate professional status. And I know that if I go out and I buy a short-term rental and I do the cost segregation on that and I self-manage, I could take the depreciation on that. But you know what? I don't have time. I've got kids destroying my house. I've got a golf league. I'm just too busy, right? For those people, is it still worth it to invest in syndications with the tax benefits? Of course, it's worth it to invest in the syndications, right? But from a tax perspective side, it's like, okay, if I'm going to get a 30% year one tax write-off-ish on my $100,000 investment, but I can't use it against my W-2 and I don't have any other passive income. Do I care about that? What are your thoughts on that?
Definitely. So in real estate investing, when it's everything is passive, you're definitely going to get a lot of benefits. You're just playing a longer game. So I like to start off with the alternative, right? If you have $50,000 to invest somewhere and you put it into a brokerage account, in that brokerage account, they'll pay you dividends, but you have to pay tax on that at ordinary rates. And then you can sell whatever you invest in at a later date and pay capital gains tax on that. But you can't shield that without taking a loss as well, right? So you could make a good investment and a bad investment and then pay no tax, but then you'll also be out the gains. Whereas in real estate, you can invest in a syndication, you could take an ordinary loss year one, then when ordinary income starts flowing in, you don't pay tax until you've used up your initial ordinary loss. And then when you go to sell, you reinvest and then can take another ordinary loss against that capital gain. So you're able to not pay any tax on all of that cash flow. Like I said, if you just look at the alternative, you can automatically see how there's benefit, and then also playing the longer gain, you can't use those losses initially, but you can use them in the future and then use the time value of money to your advantage in that respect.
And that's so perfect, because I always make this argument that if you show me two identical returns, if I'm going to make, you know, 11% in the stock market or 11% on a syndication, which would be a pretty weak return profile actually in a syndication deal, but all things being equal, I'm going to do the real estate deal all day because there's so much better tax benefits. And of course I have more leverage to take advantage of those tax benefits because sure. I'm a real estate professional. And so I'm able to take that against my W-2.
But even without it,
it doesn't matter. There's so much benefit. And so I always recommend when I, you know, talk to people casually, I'm like, you know, if you don't have the ability to write off your W-2, then you need to start building more passive income so that you can have more of that income that you can offset. So start throwing money over the fence. You know, it's a long game, like you said, Billy.
Love it.
And somebody might say too, you know, oh, I don't want to extend my tax return because I'm getting a K-1 late and I don't want to have to, you know, complicate my tax return.
Let's talk about that. This is excellent. I thought about this earlier and I forgot to ask it. So tell me your thoughts on extensions, because we have a lot of pushback. And
definitely.
I know Spartan Investment Group is excellent with on-time K-1 delivery. If you invest in enough syndication deals, you're going to have a K-1 that isn't delivered on time. We had a deal last year that the fund administration company that the sponsor used went out of business in November. So in November, they had to switch to a new accounting firm, get spooled up on a new investor platform. So obviously the K-1s were delayed. Now, it was a mobile home park deal. We got a 96.8% tax write-off.
Nice.
So it was worth the wait. So if you had invested $100,000, you got a K-1 that showed that you had a phantom loss of $96,800.
Jeez.
It was excellent. But that didn't show up till May, and it caused a lot of heartburn with a lot of our investors. So give us your perspective as a professional on tax extensions, and why should people maybe not be so scared of them?
Definitely. So the first thing to keep in mind is if it's your first investment, more likely than not, you're going to get a loss. I don't know about 96% of your investment.
and to be clear, we're not saying you're actually losing money. This is phantom. It's using depreciation.
Yes,
it's a paper loss. Great.
Right. Correct. Yeah. So when the paper loss comes in, that's not going to change your tax return all that much. And if it does, it's because you get to recognize those losses. So nothing really changes on April 15th for you. So even though the tax is due April 15th, you can file an extension. Your tax return is not due till October 15th. So all you need to do is make sure that your taxes are paid on April 15th. How do you do that? Well, you get started now. Like we said, go through Form 8582, see if you have any passive losses that you can utilize for this year. And then if you owed tax last year, so look at your 1040 page 2 to see if you had a tax due. And then make sure that you pay in enough on April 15th, and then you'll just get any balance due back to you back when you file your tax return. So a good way to go about that is just to ensure that you have an understanding of when the K-1's coming in. If, for example, they expect to have the K-1 by April 15th or even April 30th, probably don't sweat it too much. Even if you don't get your tax due right, you won't owe that much extra because you aren't waiting that long. But if you're not expecting the K-1 till October, take the time now, sit down with your tax professional, go through everything. They can use your pay stubs to determine whether or not you'll be, you know, short or flush on April 15th. And then from there, filing the tax return is just a formality if you do that planning ahead of time. And I would not recommend trying to plan on April 1st because your tax professional is busy. So right. Now's the time to get started. Right.
Well, and I will just, you know, casually plug that most airline pilots withhold a lot of tax. I'm one of the rarities where I claim 10 because I have 10 exemptions on my election form because I know that I have a ton of deductions that are going to come through. And so even with 10, I usually end up getting money back. But I know most pilots claim, you know, 0, 1, 2 on that election form, which means they have a ton of withholdings, which means every year they're going to get money back. And a K-1 that's late, that's coming from a syndication deal, is only going to help your tax situation. So it's very rare, I think, I don't want to make a false statement or be too broad here, but I think it would be a very rare case where, you know, a late K-1 triggered a tax event where you actually owed more money, unless it was in a final year where you're getting some sort of big profit from a sale on one of these things, right?
That's correct.
I have a lot of thoughts on this. So number one, if you're investing in alternatives, mm-hmm. a downside, an upside. Downside is your K-1 might come late and you're probably going to have to extend. Just get over it. Right.
I
hate to say that that way. I hate to say it that way, but you're becoming now a non-traditional investor.
Right.
So you should plan an extension. Guess what? Extensions are free.
Yep.
And it's better to extend than amend. Right, Billy? You don't want to rush to your tax return and then screw it up and then have to change it. Extensions don't really cost anything. You can extend, and then you don't have to stress about your K-1 coming later. If you're doing more and more and more syndications, if you're doing 5, 10, 15, 20 syndications, guess what? One of those operators is going to be late. And I'm using air quotes because late is not really late. It's just past the first filing deadline.
Right.
Right. And you can easily extend that all the way into October. So as an investor who's thinking about getting into this space, a warning to you, and this isn't, I'm not, you know, at Spartan, we tried it. We marched towards March 31st as being our deadline. But guess what? Accountants get sick, things get delayed, tax codes changes every year. Something might happen that actually pushes that into April, right? Yep. And so don't over rely on your operator to get it in March. Yep. You know, we kill ourselves to do that.
Right.
But, you know, if you're getting into this space, I would just say, just put on your hat of, I'm going to extend my tax return. And if I can't do that, then think differently. And one thing, one more thing I wanted to say is, you might be already in my mindset of I'm going to extend because I extend every year. And you might be not even thinking about taxes. So let's say Spartan goes in there and drops your K-1 into your investment platform. And you think, hey, I'm not even going to look at that because I'm not filing my taxes until the end of the year or closer to October. Still, I highly encourage you, go into your K-1, open it, look at it, make sure it's correct.
Right.
Like that's proper tax ID number,
yep.
Proper naming, you know, whatever it is.
Yep.
And then if it's correct, okay, put it away. Don't think about it, whatever, forward it to your CPA. Or if it's wrong, what we usually do is we actually issue all your K-1s, but we don't actually file for a couple of months because we know once we spray out 3,000 K-1s to our investors that we're going to get something wrong, whether you inputted it wrong as the investor or we got it wrong on the K-1. It's just people are people, right? I mean, we try to be our best version, but look at that K-1 and make sure it's right and get back to us right away. Any syndication, say, hey, I meant to do this in my trust and, you know, you've got my personal name, you got my social versus my tech, you know, my EIN, whatever it might be, make sure it's correct before the season marches too far along. So sorry to go on a tangent, but that's my advice to investors.
I'll just one more thing. And then I want to get your thoughts, Billy, is just because you extend and now your new deadline is October 15th, you don't have to wait till October to file.
Right.
You know, it just means that you've got until October. And it's actually really nice because you can have a much more relaxed conversation with your tax preparer than you will in March or April because everybody's trying to make that April 15th deadline. Guess what? In May, you know, you could have a leisurely call with your tax professional and actually get a whole lot more of their attention, I find. So, Billy.
You guys raised the exact two points that I was going to. So first off, definitely, you know, don't be in a rush to file. If you get that K-1 on April 10th, still take your time, review it, because that K-1 on April 10th may not be the actual filed version of it. And then you'll be in a situation where you might need to amend your return that was filed. And note that when you amend your return, the IRS looks at it. When you extend your return, there's a lower probability that you're going to be audited because they fill up their bucket and then they move on. And then to your point as well, you know, you want to have time to have that conversation with your accountant. You know, don't demand their attention April 10th.
Right.
You'll have all of it in May. So those are two great ones.
Yeah, if you're gonna call Billy to do your taxes and advise you, don't call him to set up your first appointment in March, right? Call him today.
Today. Yeah.
Because now you're ready. He's got all your documentation. You can have a successful tax season. Too often I hear my friends who are CPAs, you know, they get clients that demand everything be done in a week, you know, in April, and it's just not realistic. So,
well, speaking of calling Billy, could you tell us what an enrolled agent is? Because you are one, and that's very impressive. And I don't think a lot of people know what an EA is. And then tell us a little bit more about your firm and how people can get in touch with you.
Definitely. So an enrolled agent is basically a designation that says the IRS will let me speak to them on your behalf to your account. So there's only three types of people that have that designation, and it's CPAs, attorneys, and enrolled agents. So there's, for example, if you go to H&R Block, it could just be anybody who has, you know, taken a training helping you with your tax return. But if you go to one of those three designations, an attorney, a CPA, or an enrolled agent, if there's any issues that get uncovered, like, for example, you aren't reporting your assets for 6 years or something like that, we'll be able to head that off and get you in a better position moving forward. And if anybody wants to learn more about us, we're at www.summitats.com. ATS stands for Advanced Tax Strategy. Or you can email us hello@summitats.com.
Awesome. We'll get in the show notes. Well, Billy, we really appreciate you coming on, giving us all your wisdom and knowledge. And I think our listeners really benefit from the advice that your firm gives.
I get fired up on taxes.
Yeah, me too.
And that's because, you know, they get really fun when you start using strategies to mitigate them, and it becomes a really fun game. So give Billy a call. I think you're going to probably hear from a lot of our listeners because I get a lot of calls from people that we work with asking for advice. So thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate your guidance, and we look forward to continuing the conversation some other time.
Thanks for having me. I get fired up about taxes too.
All right. Take care.
Thanks,
catch you guys on the next episode.